Here is the sacred order of survival. First is shelter, then water, then fire, then food. If you're going to live in the wild, this is the iron law. I think all of us have wondered how we'd go living in the wild. It's a fascinating and deliciously terrifying thought. Going to a place where your skills for assembling a red-hot PowerPoint presentation count for almost nothing. Claire Dunn did this for a year. Claire lived in a forest alongside five friends. Claire learnt to build a humpy, to find bush food, to make baskets and traps, and to tan a hide. And most importantly, she learned to start a fire the old-fashioned way. Doing this for a week is one thing. To do it for a whole year suggests that Claire was looking for a seriously transformative experience. But she says the hardest part of it was not coping with the biting ants or the cold or the terror of the forest at night. The hard part, she says, was figuring out that if she was ever going to become the wild woman that she wanted to be, she had to quit trying so hard. Claire's book is called My Year Without Matches. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Richard.
What were you doing in your life when you decided you were going to do this?
Well, at the time, I was working as an environmental campaigner for the Wilderness Society and had been for many years, and for grassroots organisations for the better part of a decade. And it was just starting to feel like hard work rather than a passion. The consuming passion was now consuming me. I was pretty much growing more and more tired, disillusioned, and struggling to give the same messages with, you know, with vigour and passion, because I was just losing hope and losing energy for it, basically. But I just kept plugging away because it's what I thought I wanted for my life.
What was the last campaign you worked on?
The last campaign was a marine park for Port Stephens. And campaigning for marine national parks was kind of like campaigning for forest national parks, but 30 years ago when everyone thought you were crazy. And it was just like walking into a lion's den. And it really kind of, you know, broke the camel's back. It was just a really hard campaign that was very difficult to find support from the local community at the time. And I just grew more and more disillusioned and started to feel like no matter what I said, the words weren't sinking in. People couldn't actually connect to the message when they didn't have a connection to the environment themselves.
So if you're feeling burnt out, it must be hard then to feel authentic about what you're doing when you've got to present as a campaigner.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I started to feel more like a cardboard cutout, just kind of like, you know, the puppet in front of the cameras saying the key messages and then turning my back and going, phew, that, you know, that's over, and just struggling to actually deliver the messages with any sort of belief in them anymore. I started to not believe myself, and that's when I started to think, oh, something's got to change here, but I had no idea what or how.
Just before you left that job, you did a course, a short course. Tell me about this short course you did.
Yeah, an email popped into my inbox advertising a nature philosophy course, a 5-day course in nature awareness and wilderness survival skills. And so I rocked up with a couple of mates and found myself sleeping in a bed of leaves and learning how to light fires, well, trying to light fires without matches, and walking blindfolded through the forest at night. And
blindfolded through the forest at night?
In winter, in the mountains.
What do you mean, just stumbling through? Or were you on a chain of people?
No chain. Stumbling through blindfolded at night in the cold. And so, at first I thought, this is insane, I'm not doing this. But at the end of the experience, you know, you stumble out into the firelight and you get tapped on the shoulder, you hear, you know, you've made it. And I've never felt so alive before. Something in me just woke up and said, this, you know, this is real. This is, my senses are really coming alive here.
What happens when you have to do that, when you have to walk through the forest at night with a blindfold on?
Well, first you stumble around cursing.
There's a lot of ow.
There's a lot of ow and oh, I can't do this and,
don't.
You know, stamping. And then you've got no choice really but to let your feet lead you and let your senses lead you. And your skin kind of becomes, you know, your compass bearing. So you start to actually see the forest without your eyes, just feel your way into it. And actually what I've found since, you know, doing it a few times is you actually make your way through the forest a lot easier than if you were, you know, if you did have your sight and you were kind of, you know, breaking through the brambles. You actually find an easier path blindfolded often.
So when the blindfold comes off, it's electrifying then.
It's electrifying, and all your senses are so highly tipped because humans rely on their sense of sight so much that when you're denied sight for a while, all your other senses go, okay, we're needed here.
Going back a bit further, you went to a school in New Jersey in the United States, a tracking school. What happened there?
Yes, so after I did this short course, I kind of got really excited by the whole thing and went to a tracking and nature awareness and survival school in New Jersey with one of the world's best trackers. And that was just a wild and bizarre and fun experience. I mean, there's 120 people doing these intense courses in wilderness survival and camouflage and invisibility and awareness and tracking and learning from a guy who can literally, you know, track a mouse through pine needles. It was incredibly fascinating.
Are these Native American trackers that you're learning from, or tracking skills?
The tracking skills are certainly from the lineage of the Southern Lipan Apache, this particular school. And there's only a few places in the world where these tracking skills have been developed to such a micro level. And this was one of them, in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, of all places. And just the people who turned up to this this funny little school in the middle of nowhere it was amazing. I ended up spending quite a few weeks there.
And what did you learn to do? What did they teach you?
Well, I mean, it was like boot camp for all things survival and awareness. So some weeks it was back-to-back, you know, you'd be making traps all day or, you know, you'd be... Another week was focused on awareness skills. So this used three main tools: mud, blindfolds, and sleep deprivation. So you joined at the hip with eight other people, and you're out on missions every night, covered in camouflage, practicing your skills of awareness and observation. And
this is like bush ninja stuff, is it?
It's bush ninja stuff. And it's also the core skills of, you know, like learning how to make a fire and how to build a shelter that's going to keep you alive in sub-zero temperatures and how to make a bow and arrow set, all those core skills, but also all these awareness skills. And the whole philosophy around it as well was one of caretaking of the earth and of using these skills to, you know, develop an intimacy and a relationship with the earth. So it was the whole package that for me was kind of filling in this missing piece of the puzzle.
So, Claire, if you're covered in mud in the middle of the night in a forest somewhere and you're seeking to hide in the shadows, if you're trying to do that sort of thing, does that change the way you feel about the forest and the way you see the forest if you're trying to use the shadows rather than...
It really does. I mean, you become one of the night shadows. You become one of the night watchers, like an owl. You know, your senses get so highly tipped that you are picking up noises and sounds and feelings that you would never usually do if you're just a tourist, you know, kind of bush bashing, or if you're, you know, noisily sitting around a fire, you know, drinking beers and shining your torch around. I mean, this is when you really get to sense the forest like an animal. And that's what you're really doing is trying to drop into that sense level of connection with the forest so that you are able to observe and feel a lot more of what's going on around you that usually you'd miss, and it works.
The master tracker that was there at the school was a cult figure in his own right. What kind of tracking could you see him do? How fine were his skills?
Well, I mean, he's quite well known in the States. Tom Brown Jr., his name is, and he was well known for tracking murderers and lost children. But seeing him in action, at first I was, you know, pretty sceptical. But then after a couple of weeks of doing these advanced tracking courses, I would see how he was literally tracking mice through pine needles.
What?
And, you know, I can't do that, but I could see how he could. He would just mark out with paddle pop sticks where the actual tracks were. And then when it was pointed out to me, I started to be able to see it. I can't replicate it, but I could see it. It was possible.
So all this had been playing on your mind after you were thinking about leaving your job. You'd done this survival course in the Australian bush and this tracking course in the United States. What was the thing that made you really want to go and do it, to actually decide to leave your job and go and live in the forest for a year?
Coming back after experiences like in America and these short courses, it just became really clear to me that unless I had an intimate relationship with the bush, unless I really had an awareness of, you know, which direction the storms rolled in from, or What was the first bird of the morning was, it just felt hypocritical to me to be trying to save nature without having that that connection with it. I felt like a bit of a fraud. It didn't feel like I had that kind of bulk of experience and connection, and the story behind what I was saying just felt like empty messages without being able to speak from personal experience.
So it was like a book you wanted to read, but was there more to it than that?
Well, it was something that also just drew me inexplicably. You know, I started having all these dreams about leaving the city and going to the forest. It was like it's like a decision had already been made for me.
Right, and the front part of your brain was it was getting mail essentially about
it. That's right, and you know, finally it was just like, oh, I have to do this. I heard about this year program, and it was just, you know, I have to do this. And around that time, my grandmother fell ill, and something about that experience and that proximity to death just made me really think about what was most important to me and what my heart really was drawing me to do. And it made it easier to let go of that life that had been my passion for a decade and really let go of it and move into the next phase.
Why was your grandmother so special to you?
Well, she was the only grandparent I'd ever known, and we had an incredibly close relationship. My grandfather was priest of the local parish church, and I never knew him, but my grandma kind of retained that sense of connection to something greater. And she loved the outdoors and was always gardening. And I just felt like she was one of the few people in the world who really saw me for who I was and really appreciated my talents and what I had to offer. And I felt a softness around my grandma that didn't come out in lots of other realms of my life. I could just be with her. I could just be silent. And we were often we'd just silently sit together and on the rocking hammock and rock together. And I felt great peace around her. The thought of losing her was really hard at the time.
What was the last thing she said to you?
Well, I was leaving her room. I didn't know it was the last time I'd see her. She was 99, and she hadn't been very lucid in our conversation. She was thinking I was, you know, her mother or my mother. And then I was leaving the room, and she called out, "Darling," and I stopped in my tracks and turned around, and she said, really clearly, "Thank you for being you." And I heard those words as if they were in slow motion. It just made such an impact on me because I realized that I'd lost connection with who I was, and that one of the few people who knew that and saw that was soon not to be around.
So after she passed away, that was it. That was really the final thing that made you want to go and do this adventure for a year.
That really was the clincher. I thought, there's no point wasting time. I need to find out who I am again and connect to the something greater that I've always felt drawn to and which my grandma modelled to me. And I'd been too busy. I'd been following a passion, and it was a fantastic experience to be, an activist and a campaigner, but it wasn't my path anymore.
So tell me about these five friends you went in with. You knew all of them before you went in?
I didn't know all of them. I knew three of them. One I'd studied with at the Tracker School in America, and a couple were friends from my hometown, Newcastle, and two of them I'd never met before. So three guys, three girls.
Now, I have to say, Claire, if I was going into a forest for a year with five other people, I have to say, I'd be really wanting to be really certain of their sanity.
Yes.
And I suppose they wanted to feel the same. They would have felt the same way about you. Were you how sure were you that they could take that experience of being away from everything for?
Well, I just assumed that everyone was like me and was just so gung ho that, you know, nothing would stop them. We're all in it together. We all wanted the same thing. Let's do it. You know.
But I suppose you can think of a million reasons not to do something like this, can't you?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So I thought, you know, everyone who turns up really, really wants it. And, you know, three of them were friends of mine who I knew quite well. So I just thought, well, we'll get through it together.
What rules were there in the camp?
There were very few rules. It was the first time this program had ever been run. And the couple that were facilitating it didn't want to make too many rules. So pretty much no alcohol, no drugs, no firearms, limited days out of camp, very limited days.
So you could spend some time out.
You could spend some time out if you needed to. and limited visitors in. But apart from that, it was really choose your own adventure. There was a bit of a structure. We had instructors come in, experts in various survival skills would come in, and in the first 6 months of the year and teach us various things. And then it was after that, it was free for all, whatever you want to do. And obviously we had to build our own shelters.
Yeah, that's where you have to start.
That was the first challenge.
So then you had to go and find a spot. How did you find a spot and what did you build there?
Well, I took a long time to find my spot because I was a bit like Goldilocks. You know, I had to find the exact perfect spot because
it's house hunting, essentially.
It's house
isn't
hunting,
it?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And everyone else seemed to find their real estate quite quickly, but everything for me was too hot, too prickly, too wet, too leachy. So I got quite stressed about finding the perfect spot. But in the end, I found a good spot under some banksias, surrounded by some really large scribbly gums. And I thought, I needed to take into account both summer and winter. So enough sun, enough shade.
Oh, I see. Not too dark, not too light.
Not too dark, right. Not too light. Exactly.
But, of course, you had nothing to sleep under on your first night. So did you sleep out in the open on your first night?
Yeah, I had a swag. So it was, I just waltzed my swag into my newly acquired shelter spot. And, of course, I hadn't cleared anything, hadn't even cleared a trail at this point. And thought I'd just settle in for my first night in my new home. And up reared an intense, terrifying fear of the dark.
Yeah, now, this is the caveman brain, isn't it?
This is the caveman brain. Yeah. And I thought that I'd got over this. You know, I wasn't a newbie to the bush. I'd been working on this for a while and I'd even kind of done some overnight hikes by myself and really, because I used to be so terrified that I couldn't even, step 10 metres away from a human habitation without quivering with fear. But it all came back again. And it really was that sense of, every snap of twig, every noise I heard was a wild dog or, something out to get me. It was, and I thought, what if this happens all year? I can't stay. It's paralysing fear.
Were you being bitten?
Probably.
by ants and
most of the time
mosquitoes.
Most of the time in summer, there was, nighttime was a little bit of a reprieve. But without a mosquito net, that was early on, that was the number one survival thing. It was more important than a knife initially.
How about sleeping in those conditions when it's so black you can't see your hand in front of your face? Did you have that? Or was there always moonlight?
No. Some nights were literally that black.
Can you feel like you're floating in space under those circumstances?
Well, it is a strange sensation. Obviously, you've got the stars. Until I built my shelter, then it really was black. The blackest of black nights, you wouldn't see even the white scribbly gums right in front of me, you wouldn't see. And it was just this sense of, it was almost vertigo, kind of looking into the stars. Sometimes felt like I was looking down into the stars. I grew to love sleeping under the stars, but
I think I like that feeling, actually, looking down into the stars.
Somehow. Yeah, it spins you out a bit when you don't think you're looking up at them, actually falling into them.
So you started to build your first shelter, which was a lean-to.
Yes.
Was the labour enjoyable?
It was. Once I got my head around building what I was going to build, I decided not to build my real shelter because I had no idea what to do. I decided to build a lean-to, which would become my kitchen. That's the only shelter I could actually figure out how to build. Basically just a sloping roof, four poles, two higher than the other. And once I got into it, I just loved it.
What did you make the roof out of?
The roof was paper bark, which I always thought was going to be the no fuss primitive corrugated iron solution.
But is it?
Well, not when your roof slope is 45 degrees or less. I discovered very quickly that paper bark is not just, it's not just a matter of stripping off the paper bark in these neat, sheaths and laying them on like shingles. There's these rootlets that hold the paper bark to the tree and they create little holes all through the paper bark so the rain can get in. And I couldn't believe this when I, first discovered it in the first storm. So my 2 week lean-to ended up being more like a 6 week lean-to, which took three layers of paper bark to waterproof. And waterproof, I mean in the loosest sense of the word.
Once you're there, though, and you start to pick up the daily rhythm of life in the forest, what do you smell? What kind of scent is in the air?
Well, in summer, and that's when we arrived, it was kind of the hardest season to arrive in, but you know, there's so many things that are just flowering and just laden with nectar. So that, like, being in the swamp, the lorikeets are just shrieking and the paperbarks are just so rich with nectar. And
so it was a sweet smell.
Almost fermented sweet. It's so sweet, almost sickly sweet. And the mountain devils were all flowering, and the banksias, I mean, they flowered most of the year, but in summer, you know, you'd stick your nose in a flower in the morning and it was like alcohol. You could lick it for your morning drink. I mean, it really was a very sensory experience, that kind of, you know, everything. You smelt of smoke all the time because, of course, you're cooking on a fire. And
so things smell fantastic, in
things
other words.
Things smell really good, apart from yourself, but then you can't smell yourself after a while, so it's okay.
What would you hear all day while you're making your...
In summer, cicadas. Mm. They were like jackhammers. They were... Apparently, it was a bumper crop of cicadas. And there was this one tree that we called the loud tree. And it was literally like walking into the loudest, you know, jackhammer roadworks you could imagine. You needed earmuffs. But then when the cicadas started dropping away, then it was, you know, bird song is what you'd hear all day. And you'd start kind of tuning in to what birds are where, and certainly what birds were around my shelter site initially. And they're very evocative. Different bird sounds, you know, bird calls evoke different feelings, and the noisy fry birds and the wattle birds were really thick around my shelter site, so I can still hear their really nasally kind of bark. Imagine it now.
Early on, I was reading how you got bitten by green ants and mosquitoes, and I thought, oh, at some point she's going to meet an Aboriginal person or come up with some kind of, I don't know, forest created natural repellent. But you didn't.
No.
Yes, and leeches? Do you just have to get used to ants and leeches and mosquitoes?
Pretty much. I mean, there really is no other option. You have to get used to them. You can have a smoky fire going, but then you have to be hanging around a smoky fire. It was the midges, though, that were the worst. Oh. You know, the mosquitoes were bad at dawn and dusk, but the midges, they're tiny, but they don't care if you're running. They will find you and they will bite you, and they sting.
So given that you're there to kind of really, you know, commune with nature, that's another way of communing with nature in a way that's not pleasant at all. Don't you get to quickly go, oh, I'm just covered in bites and leeches and I'm not liking nature anymore and I want to go home?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there was times in summer it just felt plain miserable. I mean, the heat was intense and there's nowhere to escape. I mean, the other seasons were easy in comparison. Summer is really difficult. The honeymoon was over pretty quickly. I mean, it was literally a case of all I want is a cold drink and a little bit of air conditioning or somewhere where I'm not getting bitten up, and there's literally nowhere to escape. Luckily, we had the waterhole. That was a saviour.
Did you wear a watch?
I took a watch with me, but I only took it as like a, you know, just a backup in case I ever needed the time. So I stashed it quite early on, kind of under layers, and tried to forget where it was. But I found it initially really hard to give up the watch, and it made its way back out of the hidden spot because I found it really disorientating. I'd need to look at the time to see whether it was lunchtime.
Why?
Or whether it was just really disorientating. It was really hard to
kind of... It's like you had appointments, was it? I mean,
no appointments, but... You know, I sometimes couldn't tell whether it was 11 a.m. or 3 p.m. And there was something in me that really needed to know what the time was. I guess it was the part that likes to be in control. I mean,
I'm just wondering what that is, because I'm certain I'd be exactly the same. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, what is it about us that needs to know the time when we're living in a forest and we have no appointments?
I know. I just thought it would be as simple as I was craving this kind of timelessness and spaciousness and no appointments and no emails and no media releases. But in practice, it's really hard to just let go and let yourself flow in your own rhythm. And also really hard to tell what time it is by the sun, because in summer the sun just seems to stay up in the middle of the sky for hours and hours.
You had to find a sit spot in the forest. Mm. What's a sit spot?
A sit spot is a place that it's like an anchor that you use to come to know the animals and the plants of the forest. It's like a baseline. So rather than just wandering around observing whatever you come across, if you get to know one place really well through all the seasons, then it will give you a baseline of what the forest is doing better than if you just wandered around. So it was where I'd go for at least an hour a day and sit and watch.
On ABC Local Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
I'm with Claire Dunn. Claire is the author of a book called My Year Without Matches. It's the story of her going to live in a forest, New South Wales, for a whole year, building her own shelter, finding her own food, learning to start a fire. So we were talking about your sit spot that you found in the forest, which is the place where you go and sit for an hour every day?
At least an hour every day with my binoculars and just watch, just soak it all in, listen, observe. And birds just became my kind of in, really, to the forest. They just taught me so much about what was going on in the forest, and I was never bored at my sit spot.
Can you perceive the drama of the lives of these birds from your sit spot?
Well, I quickly discovered all the different personalities around me. There was the highly neurotic white-cheeked honey eaters that were always, you know, on some kind of territorial skirmish or family, you know, drama going on. Then there was the matronly wonga pigeons on the ground, and the beautiful eastern spinebills and the wrens would come in. And you know, I just started sketching all the birds and developing a list that just got bigger and bigger. And because I was so new to bird watching, it was just like this game of discovery, and I was a detective, and I couldn't wait to get to my sit spot every morning and see what had turned up and what had changed.
These days people find it boredom so intolerable you have to look at your iPhone while you're in a queue. Did you find your city-based boredom threshold stretching, disappearing?
The funny thing, I was never bored initially, but what I found really difficult was the busy city mind, like the chatter, just didn't drop away. It took ages to quieten my mind down, and certainly doing the sit spot practice helped. But I guess because we always had something, you know, there was some skill I was trying to learn. There was always some kind of something I was working on, some kind of stimulation in the first few months anyway.
So you're still being, even in the forest, a really goal-directed modern person. Like, now I will learn this and master this. Now I will learn something else, master that, and move on to the next thing. So at the end of the week, I can say, tick, I've learnt this.
Pretty much. Yeah, I really was.
Were you aware you were doing this?
Well, not initially. You know, I just thought, well, I've got to build a shelter. I've got to learn how to make fires. I'm here to learn all these skills. But then it became a little obvious after a while. I started still making lists in my journal and starting to feel, you know, pressure to, I haven't tracked yet, and it's, you know, it's the afternoon and I haven't practiced this and I haven't done this and I haven't done that. And it was like I had all these key performance indicators that were telling me how well I was or wasn't doing, just the same as back home.
Because it wasn't life or death, because you could have bailed out and, you know, you went in danger, really. Well, not really. You weren't going to starve to death in that situation. So if it's not a matter of life and death, then it is a matter of self-improvement then. And you can get into that whole cycle of, am I improving? Am I getting better at this?
Absolutely.
Am I worthy of what I'm putting myself through?
That's right. And I came to see myself as, this kind of amount of pressure that I was putting on myself and this kind of level of need to achieve some kind of mastery on these skills was just another form of striving and ambition, which is what I, you know, had been running away from, really, and wanting to break that habit of. And I just replaced the furniture, but the kind of the conditioning and the patterns were still playing out. But because I was in the forest on this kind of year out, I got to see it in a new way. I got to see that conditioning and how kind of rigid it made me and how much it controlled my experience of life and controlled the way I my identity, really.
So that's the longest part of the journey. You talk about it early on there. You started, you and everyone else started to bicker with each other, you and your five other friends. There was a lot of bickering. Is there something about that kind of an experience where you are taken into the wild, where pretty soon a lot of the toxic stuff that's there from your life starts to come to the surface?
Absolutely.
Personalities?
And I could see it in all of us. We were undergoing this kind of collective detoxification, and all our city sludge was kind of coming to the surface and bubbling up because we didn't have all the stimulation and the distractions and the normal ways that we comfort ourselves available. And it really became a case of all our stuff bubbling up and bumping against each other. And then, you know, eventually kind of took myself off and...
Yeah, the others got annoyed with you because they thought you were too judgmental because you they were using matches and you thought the point is not to use matches. And
yeah.
And I did get a sense of your kind of low-level anger that you you had. You were directing to other people and yourself, but mostly to yourself. Is that fair to say that, do you think?
Well, that's one of the other the kind of mirrors that whole experience showed me was this level of self-criticism. But also, judging other people's experience. And I had a very clear idea of what I wanted out of that year and how I wanted it to be. And when it didn't quite stack up to that or it wasn't quite what I was expecting, then that judgment was certainly directed outwards. But then also I began to see how much that level of self-judgment dictated my experience and realised that that was something I'd been living with all my life and that I'd just internalised that voice. But now... through spending so much time alone, especially through winter, I started to just see how, you know, painful that experience was and to really start to break that and to pick it apart. And so it sometimes felt like there was this civil war going on inside me.
Food. You were able to take a bit of food from the outside world in with you, but the point was to find food within the forest. What food was readily available there in the forest?
Well, there wasn't enough to live on, so we certainly needed to take in other supplies. But as I got to know more of the plants, I was eating bush food every day. There was lots of berries around, sour currants and geebungs and dianellas, and I was always munching on lamandra or, you know, taking nectar from one of the flowers. And we also experimented with if we had to harvest a grass tree, or bangalow palm, you know, that's a key source of carbohydrate. And then we started to think about meat, and certainly my body was crying out for meat. So we went on a survival trip together, and that was one of my first experiences of collectively hunting. And then towards the second half of the year, I started to hunt myself.
Yeah, tell me about that, what it's like to go to hunt for food, hunt meat for food.
Well, I figured out that my skill level was better adapted to trapping rather than spearing. So I eventually decided that I would try and trap a wallaby, and I'd been looking at this particular area all year and I knew where the wallabies would feed and I knew where they'd move to. So I set a snare trap on a fence line.
How did it work?
It was just like a really simple snare where it's like a noose. So as the wallaby went under the fence on their normal feeding route, the snare would tighten around its neck like a noose. And
a slip knot, wasn't it?
Like a slip knot and strangle it hopefully quickly and fairly painlessly. But, you know, I set these traps and never actually really thought they'd work. It was more, I don't know, it was more like kind of practicing. And then one day I really thought, I don't want to leave this year until I've experienced what it's like to kill and eat a wild animal. And once I'd made that intention, pretty soon after that, I came across, I checked the traps every morning and there was a wallaby and I couldn't believe it. And
was it dead when you got there?
It was dead and had been dead for quite a few hours, possibly all night. And then started the real work, you know, that I the experience of carrying this wallaby the 2 kilometres home in the rain, I was bawling, I was distraught that I'd taken this animal's life, even though I knew it was the experience I wanted because I ate meat, and I didn't want to not have that connection with my food source. So when I got back to camp, a couple of others came in, I sent out the cooey that I needed help, and then it was a case of... stringing up this wallaby and gutting it and skinning it and cooking it.
That process, I mean, it's incredibly intense.
It is intense.
Incredibly intense because what are your feelings towards that animal as you're doing that?
I was so emotional as I was skinning this thing.
What were you saying? Were you talking to the dead animal?
I was, you know, apologizing and saying sorry, and then I was thanking it profusely for its life, and I just felt such gratitude and reverence for. It felt like this creature had sacrificed its life in order for me to have this experience. Really,
this is really common in indigenous hunting cultures that there's often some kind of prayer or statement of gratitude that's made to the animal that's killed to provide food.
Yep. And I had an overwhelming sense that I wanted to honour its life by using every part of its body that I could. So cooking and eating everything, tanning its hide. We kept the paws to learn how to track. And, you know, I tried to... And it was a long process. I mean, tanning the hide takes days in itself, but using every part of the meat that we could, I really wanted to give this wallaby everything I had.
When the author David, American author David Vann was on this program, he talked about his first hunt of a deer when he was a kid, and he said he was expected to eat the heart. That was part, the final part of your first kill was to eat the heart of the animal you killed. Did you do that?
I did do that. I hadn't really thought of that. And then Ryan, one of the other participants, said, hey, you know, it's your first hunt. You've got to eat the heart. So... this slippery little nugget in my hand, I cooked it and ate it. And I've never tasted anything so amazing.
What do you mean? What way?
It was so rich, and it tasted like kind of grassy meat, but so nourishing. It just felt like I came alive. Like, it felt like I had instant energy.
How hungry were you before you ate it?
I was pretty hungry. I mean, I hadn't eaten all day, and had taken this was the afternoon, and I'd been dealing with this wallaby all day, so I was starving. And I hadn't eaten meat either for ages because I had an only wild meat policy. So we'd been eating a bit of roadkill and a few other things that people had trapped or eaten, but I hadn't eaten meat in quite a while.
So you had this kind of huge bit of protein all of a sudden,
and it just entered my cells, and I felt myself coming alive. And then I had this realization that, well, I'm actually part wallaby now. You know, I'm eating this wallaby. Where do I begin and end, and where does wallaby begin and end? And it was like this experience of course, you know, it's not my life is, you know, the purpose of my life is to live honourably, partly to honour all the lives that I have consumed.
What do you think we don't know now that we buy our meat largely from, you know, in a plastic tray in a supermarket rather than kill it?
Well, we're just so alienated from its source, and alienated from the experience of killing. So it doesn't engender that sense of the sacred and that sense of awe and reverence for what it is to take a life.
There's no gratitude, is there? I suppose what we see is a cartoon chicken on the side of the refrigerator unit at the supermarket or something like that, that's smiling, like saying, thank you for eating me. But it doesn't go the other way around.
It doesn't.
Making a fire, that seems like the hardest lesson to learn of all the practical skills, without matches, without a lighter.
Yes.
What was required? We're told we'd rub two sticks together. That's not going to work, though, is it?
Well, it does work, but with a hell of a lot of elbow grease. And I was absolutely determined.
Yeah, I'm going to be dead before I get that right if I get stuck in the wild, Claire, aren't I? But literally, though, aren't I? Unless I've got some other kind of technique. Rubbing two sticks together, what takes weeks to master, doesn't it?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I've seen people sit down and do it the first time, get it the first time. And women, I've seen women get it the first time, which makes me...
Really annoyed?
Really annoyed, because it took me years. I mean, I don't have an amazing amount of upper body strength, but hand drill, which is the indigenous... Australian way, was when I first saw it done, I just thought it was like witnessing a birth. It was that
Explain
profound.
It to me. What is it? How does it work?
It's one stalk, it was a grass tree flower stalk, dried grass tree flower stalk that you spin with your hands down onto a piece of small timber, onto a board, and the dust collects in the notch, and then eventually, if it's hot enough, it will join together and create a coal. And
how long does that take?
Well, it doesn't really take that long. I mean, you can't keep up the pressure and the speed required for more than 5 minutes. So if you don't get it in 5 minutes, you don't get it, basically. And I wanted it more than anything else. So I made a no matches, no lighter rule, because I knew the greater the need, the greater the result. But it became my ally and my enemy and my best friend, and it was my intimate partner, fire, because I struggled with it so much. It took months before I got my first hand drill coal. And
what kind of blisters were on your hands at that stage from drawing?
Oh, I had blisters the size of 20 cent coins, blood blisters the size of 20 cent coins, which would burst sometimes. But
and you'd still do it with those blisters?
I'd still do it. I was just so determined. There was something about it. It was like if I could get fire in this way, it was like it symbolized some kind of alchemy that I could then do anything that I wanted in my life. So I just wanted it more than anything. But the flip side was I came to realize that it was actually only through letting go of wanting it so much that I was actually going to achieve any kind of proficiency with it.
I don't get that. I don't understand that. What you mean, as soon as you didn't want it, you could make fire? I don't get it.
Well, it required technique and it required strength, which took me a long time. But then the last piece of the puzzle was it required me to actually be fluid and flowing with it rather than so tense. And there was one time where I put a blindfold on. So instead of being able to see how close I was or how far away and start cursing and, you know, I just felt and I just listened and I let go of the whole idea of getting a fire. And then I could hear it. I heard the sound change. And when I heard that really sweet spot, that the dust just coalescing, I knew that I had it. And there was, I wouldn't say it was effortless, but there was something that had really shifted in that experience.
You know this is Luke Skywalker on the Millennium Falcon, don't you, with a blindfold and a lightsaber? You do know that, don't you? There may be some truth to that at that moment.
Maybe.
And that feeling when you'd succeeded at last, after with the bloodied and blistered hands, you'd actually made fire at last.
It was probably the most joyful moment I can remember. That first, sitting around that first fire that I'd made with hand drill, my own hands, it just felt like I was, I had the spark of life or, this incredible being was here only because of my hands and my skill and my determination.
You built this beautiful humpy. There's pictures of it in your book. Making a humpy out of grass, though, bending saplings to form the round shape of it. You got your dad to come in and help you to do it, which is lovely too. And and filling it, packing it with grass. It looks so beautiful, that humpy.
Oh,
but
it
the
is,
work.
Was so, I mean, incredible amount of work. And initially I wanted to do paper bark until I found out the paper bark
wasn't really going to work
that well. And then the fallback was thatching with grass. Of course, that's an incredible amount of tedious grass pulling, bundling and tying on. It really was a good 2 months of work. The shelter was just the most gorgeous thing I've ever made in my life.
What did you have for a bed?
I had my swag. So I'd built a little kind of platform with timber. So I was off the ground, 5 inches, and then had my swag on that. So, and a fire inside my shelter with a little chimney. And there was an underground air tunnel that kind of aerated the fire. So it was cozy.
Reading your book, you got angry with your dad because he was cutting down saplings too quickly and you wanted to give some ceremonial vote of thanks.
Yes.
It seems like the longer you were in there, in the forest, the more the world of signs and significance came into everything you're doing. It seems like That's part of that experience where magical thinking just blends into day-to-day life.
Absolutely. I mean, especially when I spent a lot of time alone, which was in winter and spring, the kind of the day world and the night world, the dream world kind of blurred a bit. And I was doing a lot of walking around at night and my dreams were incredibly vivid and a lot of wild animals in my dreams. And it really felt like I was entering into some kind of underworld. And that whole idea of, of entering into the forest and undergoing some kind of transformative experience and some kind of an initiatory experience, it really felt like that was happening. I started to kind of see the landscape around me more in terms of like a dream world, like in terms of symbols and signs and omens, and it became a very imaginative place to live and very alive place to live.
Your time in the forest went from summer into autumn into winter. Mm-hmm. How did the sound of the forest change? And how did it change over
Significantly. A lot of the birds migrated north. while for winter. So it was very, very subdued in winter. And it was good in that way. I got to know the core birds that stuck around the whole year really well. And they joined together in these feeding flocks. So it was, the silence was much more palpable in winter, and especially at night. I mean, it was just really still. And there was hardly any wind in winter. So it almost felt like walking around in this kind of, China doll landscape. It was really crisp, pristine.
Towards the end of your stay there was an open day where friends and family could, from the outside world, could come in and see what you guys are doing, which is lovely. Reassure them you hadn't joined a cult of some kind or whatever. And at the end of it, you know, people were pretty pleased by what they'd seen you'd been able to achieve. And at the end of it, you had to make an account of yourself to everyone and speak. So what did you say? Account for yourself, Claire Dunn. What did you say? It had come out of your time.
I didn't really know what I was going to say. And there was quite a crowd there. And storytelling is a really important part of the process. And what I found myself saying and what most of us said at the end was not about skills mastery, but about what we learned about ourselves. And for me, I was really talking about how I felt like I'd had a complete kind of rearrangement of my identity. My old identity had really dropped away, and I'd started to embrace a more kind of softer, more feminine way of being, much more fluid, much slower and more receptive, rather than me trying to control the way I thought my day or my week or my life was going to go. Seeing it more as a process rather than something to be achieved or, you know, certain things ticked off a list. And so the overall message that I talked about was about coming back to my heart and coming back to my kind of my essential self and rediscovering that part of me through being in the forest.
One by one, the other five left. And then it was just you, all alone.
Yes.
What was that like, being all alone?
Well, it wasn't really the plan, but it just kind of ended up me being alone in the last couple of weeks. And then I really felt ready to leave. You know, then it was a case of I've done this time. I've done my time. And after the whole open weekend and the storytelling and the ceremonial fire and the thank yous and the farewells and the gratitude to the land, it really was like the show's over. It's time to leave. And I was all ready to kind of settle in for the last 3 weeks. And actually, I just felt like it was time to go.
Had your relationship with the others, the bickering I mentioned earlier, had that repaired?
It had repaired. We'd all kind of chilled out and really seen each other for who we really were and let each other kind of have our own experience without trying to kind of control it. So we're all good mates still. Which is lovely.
What did you do when you left the forest? Did you bawl your eyes out, or were you just happy to get on with the next phase of your life?
I was really ready to leave the day I kind of packed up, and I was walking across the bridge back to civilization, and I actually slipped through it was the creek was flooded, and I slipped on a board and actually slipped into the flooded creek, and in my city clothes, and ended up halfway down the creek, and I thought it was I was kind of rushing to get out. And I thought it was a really nice way of the land telling me
steady
to slow
on,
down, steady on, you know, don't be in such a hurry, and you know, keep one
now?
Foot in the wilds. So I left quite humbled and dripping wet.
Where do you live now?
I live in Newcastle near the beach. I miss the bush. I really miss living in the bush. But
you didn't want to go back to live in Sydney after that?
I tried living in Sydney. I couldn't handle it. I was become so sensitive that it was just the busyness and the stimulation was just too much.
Have you been back to that forest since then?
I have been
then?
Back. And
what did you see when you got there at your old campsite?
Well, I walked in and the first thing I saw was that my shelter had pretty much fallen into a pancake with one elbow sticking up. And I didn't realise how emotional I'd be walking back into that site. It was like all the feelings and the intensity of the experience was kind of snap frozen there. And walking back in, it was literally like walking straight back into the experience. And I kind of buckled to my knees and wept, really. I had such such a realization of what that year was and how enormous it was for me.
Was it hard for you to accept that that shelter was now going to go back into the ground?
Absolutely.
That's the way of things, didn't you?
Yes, I know. And you know, entropy kind of had its way with my shelter, and I knew it wouldn't last forever. But there was something about it was my first ever own home, and it was such a cocoon that I underwent, you know, such a transformation in, that the thought of it not being there anymore was quite disturbing.
What stayed with you since then?
My relationship with birds, my kind of my love of nature and my passion for those skills and for sharing those skills is still really alive. And I've left, but I've got all sorts of plans of, you know, building a shelter somewhere else, and I've still got hides salted, and I'm still making baskets, and it still feels to me like the most powerful way to have that ongoing relationship with the land. And yeah, the fire is still burning.
Claire Dunn, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.